All right, so this will be my, those of you who've been here for 10 minutes, I apologize. We like to start in advance just so we can get this sort of administrative piece of things going. We've got about a minute or two till we'll get started, but if you have a web-enabled device with a web browser on it, feel free to go ahead and point your device over toward that URL up there. There's some open questions. It's a cloud-based audience response system that we developed at the University of Minnesota. We'll have those open questions as we go. This is the first question here, the question about who we are, and so you can get a little bit of a sense of who's sitting next to you, who's out in our audience here. And it looks like we're moving on toward 10, and figuring out how to support the cloud takes a full hour, so I think we should just go ahead and get started here. It's an interesting mix. We've got some instructional technologists, some senior administrators. It's kind of a nice little histogram that we've got going on here, so hopefully we'll have something else. Some of the others, does anybody want to fess up? What other types of units do we have? Yeah. A librarian, and that's the one that I thought, oh, we missed one. Yeah, a big class, so we might assume we're librarians. Okay, well, we'll go ahead and get started here. I want to thank you all for coming today. Just a quick round of introductions. We're going to be convening our own session today. So my colleague Ed Clark here on the right, who's the Vice President for Technology and CIO for Minnesota State University Mankato. My name is Jude Higdon, and I work in the College of Pharmacy at the University of Minnesota, but have also worked in the College of Liberal Arts and collaborate with people across the university, so I'll be talking about some of those activities. And then my esteemed colleague, Dr. Chad Topaz, who's an associate professor in the Department of Math, Statistics, and Computer Science at McAllister College. And you've seen the goals for this session. They're all in there, but it's worthwhile to just sort of put them up there. So we'll get started there. The reason that we brought this crowd together, and it's sort of a bit of an eclectic group up here. We've got the different types of institutions, sort of R1 public, teaching public, and liberal arts faculty, as well as faculty at academic technology and sort of more senior technology administrator. And just in our own interactions with each other, in talking about how we approach these things, the cloud, we realized that we all had very different perspectives and we're sort of really approaching them and thinking about them in some pretty different ways. So part of what we're hoping to do is sort of articulate some of the ways what each of us brings to the process and sort of use that as a launching point maybe for some ideas about ways to do more vertical integration around support at our institution. So Chad will start with the faculty perspective, Ed will talk about the CIO perspective, and I'll talk about the academic technology perspective. And you're welcome to post questions to that chime-in feed at these two web addresses. As part of a sort of a general orientation toward an open knowledge approach, we have published this as a Google presentation, which is what we're presenting from right now. So this presentation, if it changes everything for you, you'll always be able to go back to it and use this as a reference ongoing. And that's at zed.umin.edu/ELI2012. And then the chime-in feed will be open throughout our talk today. So feel free to post questions there or to save them for the end. I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Topaz.
Okay, thanks, Jude. And I'm actually going to get out in front of the podium here. Thanks for coming today. I want to tell you about a little bit of work that I've been doing at McAllister College, which is a liberal arts college in St. Paul, Minnesota. We have about 2,000 students. It's a private institution. And I'm a faculty member in mathematics. And what I want to do for you in the next 10 or 12 minutes is just motivate a little bit of instructional design via a particular learning science framework. I want to tell you how I've implemented that in an applied calculus class that I teach at McAllister. And in particular, I'll focus on the use of two tools that involve the cloud, namely LiveScribe and Google Moderator. Okay, so let me give you just a little bit of institutional and curricular context for this class. The class I'm talking about is Applied Calculus, Math 135 at McAllister. It's designed in conjunction with faculty members from other fields in which mathematics is a service discipline, so primarily biologists and economists. And they actually require this course for their majors, as do some other majors at our institution. There aren't many prerequisites for this course. It assumes just high school algebra. And although it is a course for non-majors, it's actually been an unexpected gateway into our major for us. So we find that students like the class so much that some of them decide to major because of it. But still, for most students, it's envisioned as part of a sequence with another course for non-majors that's on statistics. We teach about 120 students in 5 sections per year, and almost a third of our seniors graduate having taken this course at some point during their 4 years. Okay, so I'm just a math guy, so if I can get up to date on learning science, even to the year 2000, that's really good, because many of us mathematicians are still in the 18th or 19th century. So the pedagogical framework that I keep in mind is one that probably many of you are familiar with. This is How People Learn, which was published around the turn of this century by the National Academies. And it was sort of an overview of what was known about learning science from different perspectives, neuroscience, psychology, sociology, and more. And for me, one of the key chapters is the chapter that's on the design of successful learning environments. And that's what I'm representing here with a Venn diagram. Since I am a mathematician, I like Venn diagrams. And the idea is that successful learning environments have 4 different centrisms. And knowledge centrism refers to putting some emphasis on the disciplinary knowledge. In other words, it's hard to have a successful math class if you don't put some emphasis on mathematics and if the professor doesn't have some expertise there. Learner-centeredness refers to emphasis to individual learners and their backgrounds and misconceptions that they might carry into the classroom. Assessment-centeredness refers to providing not just summative assessment, but many opportunities for ongoing formative assessment in order to give feedback both to the students on how they're doing and to me as the instructor. And finally, community-centeredness means a number of things, but to me, the most important aspect is the opportunity for students to learn as part of a community of peers and the opportunities that that opens. So this is what How People Learn says successful learning environments look like. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that in my own discipline of mathematics, this is typically what the learning environments have looked like historically. There's a huge emphasis on the knowledge-centered aspect and very little on anything else. And so when I first learned about How People Learn, I sort of used that as a way to think about how could I start bringing in some of these other important centerednesses. Okay, so here's what I actually do. I'll give you an overview, and then we'll delve into each of these a little bit more. This is based on the sort of flipped classroom model that some of you might be familiar with from the K-12 literature. In case you're not, the main idea is that the sort of didactic portions of class, the lecture-based portion of class, happens before class in an online format. And I do that using the LiveScribe pen. And then this frees up class time to do sort of more dialogic things. There's a step that happens in between here that I do, which is where students pose and answer each other's questions online using Google Moderator, which is another cloud-based tool. And I'll tell you about each of these in a little bit of detail. Okay, so what I do is I record my lectures before class using the LiveScribe pen. This is what it looks like, in case you're not familiar with it. It's a special pen where you can write on special paper, and it syncs up the voice that's being recorded with what's being written on the paper. And this is really a way of addressing the knowledge-centered aspect of the class, right? So this is the sort of didactic part where I'm doing essentially the same thing that I would be doing if I chose to stand up in front of a blackboard during class. Now I want to show you an example of what this actually looks like, what the students see. So I record these lectures, they get put online, and students can do the following, if you can full screen it. Students see something that looks like this.
Sorry, we don't have, okay, there we go.
So this lecture is on dimensional analysis. This is part one of the 2 lecture series on this topic. And the goals for this lesson are as follows.
So this is what students see. They have the ability to fast forward and reverse, and they can pause, they can jump around to different parts of the lecture.
And
what they see,
so here's the example where this
they see text appearing just as it would if I were writing on a blackboard.
Take this.
Okay, thanks.
So I'll really show.
Okay, so let me just outline a few of the pros and cons of using this. One pro is that this is a cloud-based, non-college tool, right? So it's something that lives out there in the cloud, in particular on a proprietary site that's operated by LiveScribe. Students can access it from anywhere. I can access it from anywhere. It's very convenient. for students, something I hadn't anticipated is that the number one thing that they like about it, they tell me very clearly, is that there's a pause button. They freely admit to me that they have short attention spans, and they say, we zone out after 10 minutes, and now we can hit the pause button, come back to it later, or if we miss something you said, we can reverse. It's a pretty cheap tool, so it costs the students nothing, and it costs me on the order of $100 to buy the pen. And it's very easy to use. I learned how to use it in about 5 minutes. Many of you could probably learn how to use it in less time than that. And something that's critical for me as a faculty member is that there's a low activation energy for recording these things. And what I mean by that is that there's little sort of technical overhead needed. I don't need to be in a studio with a camera in front of me at some particular time. I don't need anyone to help me do it. I can just pull out my pen in my office or at home or in the coffee shop and decide to record a lecture whenever I feel like it. And that's been an immense efficiency of using this for me. It's a free publishing mechanism. In other words, after I spend $100 on the pen, it doesn't cost anything to put these lectures up there in the cloud. And another efficiency for me is that if I get one good recorded lecture, it lasts me a really long time. And the material of a course like applied calculus does not change significantly from term to term. So I can get good use out of a good recorded lecture for quite a few years. On the downside, just as it's a pro, I think a con is that it's a cloud-based non-college tool. So I'm very fortunate at my institution to have an amazing staff of academic technologists who help me out with things, and some of them are in this room, for which I'm very grateful. This tool is not something that's an official institutionally supported tool, and if something goes wrong with it, if something goes wrong with LiveScribe, there's little that we can do about it. Editing is impossible with this format, so if I make a mistake, I have to cross it out and continue, or I have to abandon my recording and start a new one. I can't sort of splice things together from different parts of different lectures. That's not a capability. And also, the medium is limited. So all I can do is the same thing I can do if I were standing at a blackboard, right? I can't project a piece of mathematical software or show a graph that I've produced or anything like that. I can just write. The first semester that I decided to do this was extremely labor intensive. So I had to get these lectures recorded in enough lead time so that students could watch them before class. And that was quite a challenge. And then every term that I do this, in a class of 30, I have one or two students who complain essentially that I am not teaching them. So in other words, I found that it's hard for students to let go of the model that they're used to, which is they walk into class and I stand up at the blackboard. And when that doesn't happen, no matter how explicitly I talk about it with them, the reasons that we're doing learning this way, there are always a couple who are resistant. Okay, so after students listen to the lecture and after they do whatever reading is assigned, they go on to Google Moderator. And if you're not familiar with Google Moderator, you can sort of think of it as a group blog where students can post different things, they can respond to each other, and critically for me, as I'll show you in a moment, they have the opportunity or the ability to thumbs up and thumbs down each other's posts, and that's really useful. What I ask students to do in Google Moderator is to articulate their specific points of difficulty with the material that they have listened to for the next day's class. So basically I say, post what your questions are and you should try to respond to each other. So can you go back for one second to the slide? That's quite all right. So this addresses knowledge-centeredness because it's putting some emphasis on that particular material assigned for the day. It addresses learner-centeredness in that it forces each student to articulate their own specific points of difficulty, and they get responses to those both from their peers and the next day from me in class. Right? So everyone is getting some individualized attention this way, and they all do it because I grade it, so everyone participates. I mean, it's community-centered because it does create this online learning community where they can answer each other's questions. So this is what it actually looks like. And so this is what a student would see when they log in. At the top, they're being shown somebody else's post, and they're being asked whether or not they think it's a good question. And they'll be prompted to vote on a few questions. And you can see, if you scroll down, you can see other questions that have been posted, and you see a little bar next to each one, and that bar essentially indicates the level of popularity. And this is fantastic for me, because before I had access to Google Moderator, I used to actually have students keep blogs, and I would have to aggregate their questions by hand and try to sort them into some priority on my own. And here, Google Moderator does it for me. So it's great to be an instructor. All I can do is just walk into class, pull up this web page, see a prioritized list of what people's questions were, and I can start talking about them. Okay, so some pros and cons. It's free. It's great. It's part of our the Google App Suite that we have at our institution. And it does this automatic prioritization of questions, which is hugely efficient for me. It has the intuitive Google interface that students are used to, so they can use it right away without really having to learn anything. And there's a very robust back end. It never goes down. On the downside, it's not part of our institutional system. It's not part of Moodle, which is what we use at McAllister. And so I sometimes find it inconvenient that I sort of go back and forth between looking at things in Google Moderator and grading them in Moodle. And also, students are sometimes resistant. You know, it's a sort of it's new for them to be asked to somewhat publicly indicate their points of difficulty. And so I talk to them a lot about sort of how we're going to build a safe community learning environment where it's okay for them to express their difficulties in front of other students. Okay, so again, to sum up, this is what I do. I do lectures in a pre-class format with the LiveScribe pen. Students pose and answer each other's questions online using Google Moderator. And then this is really the critical part for me. These are ways of freeing up class time for me. So class time now, my 90 minutes twice a week that I get with them, can be spent on this host of other activities that are really the emphasis of what I want to do. So I can do question and answer with them. I can do assessment. I do assessment every day with PRS clickers and other things as well. We do small group work. We do large group work. We do computer labs and all these other things that would be sort of edged out if I didn't have this pre-class lecture capability. Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you, Chad. So now we're going to turn it over to Ed Clark, who's going to give us kind of a CIO perspective about building a vertical support model for the cloud.
Thanks, Jude. So I'm going to start with some basics, but I plan to go through this part pretty quickly because all of this stuff is easily found online, and a lot of it you probably have heard before. So just thinking about Chad's service, you know, I would think about, well, what were the terms of service for LiveScribe? You know, I mean, what can they do with that data? And so one of my colleagues, Diane Daggerford, who's the CIO at Ohio State's Arts and Sciences, pointed me towards this these sort of guidelines that they have there, which are really good. And they cover items like intellectual property and copyright. In the terms of service, often these cloud providers say, if you put it up here, it's our stuff. You know, which has, you know, that is an issue for lots of folks. Also, these terms of service can change at any time. As you know, I mean, you may have noticed Facebook just changed their terms of service for maybe the 100th time. So this is something to watch out for. There are privacy and data security concerns, potentially, that you need to be aware of. And then finally, many of us that are at public institutions, you know, we're required to be able to, under Open Records Acts, to get this data at any time. So getting it out of the cloud and bringing it to for discovery may be an issue. So part two of the basics. You know, ways to get around these issues, creating a private cloud. And that's where, you know, a company could invest in its own hardware and its own storage to be able to provide cloud-like services. And so how do we, these are the considerations that you would think about. You know, the criticality, service levels, usage patterns, and whatnot. And of course, you know, the bottom bullet is perhaps the most important of all. Can your IT shop really do this? That is, it's not easy, and it costs a lot of money to do this. And you, by the way, we will have the URLs for this information, so we'll get that. The third basic is to have a development team that can develop for the cloud. And so InfoWorld had these 9 gotchas. And these 4 in particular were really relevant to our talk today. So it's an unfamiliar territory for people who have been developing traditional styles. There is a lack of documentation. And, of course, there are these strange deployment restrictions that you may run across with certain cloud licenses. And it all ties back to this rate of change. You know, things are changing so quickly, and for some developers, if they've been coming out of a very .NET or corporate type background, this is going to be a challenge for them. So what does this mean? Support flexibility. I saw some of you are CIOs out here. You've probably seen this. When people talk about rapid change, what it really means is standardization becomes impossible. You know, and that used to be the old way to control things. This, hey, 10 years ago, same machines. We're only going to run 2 kinds of machine. We're only provide support for it. Anything else we'll throw out the door. That doesn't work anymore. Multiple devices means people are bringing their own devices. I'm sure you've seen that on your campuses. People bring whatever they want, and then they expect you to make it connect somehow. And then finally, connect anywhere means support anywhere. You're going to get calls from all over the place. How do I make this work at home? How do I make this work overseas? These are big issues that maybe you haven't had to deal with before. But getting back to the goals of the talk, the goal from my part, you know, of this presentation is, how do you create this collaborative shared support structure at your own institution, utilizing strategies here to build support activities around cloud computing? And so I have a model to propose, and I think this is more interesting here. And I call it the three-layer model. We imported this into the cloud, and so it has it's a little buggy, you might notice, but. So this three-layer model involves at the top consultation, the second layer is translation, and then infrastructure. So at the local unit, the consultant would translate your strategic activities for teaching and learning into some support model that makes sense. So for example, if you're in computer science and or geography, it probably makes sense you need to know about GIS, high performance computing, probably some clusters. And these things would be different, perhaps, than the run-of-the-mill kind of activities you'd see at other units. So all of that generates data that's stored on infrastructure, servers and storage, pass-through networks. So at the top, it's always local. At the bottom, it should always be centralized. You don't want local units trying to build their own infrastructure. It costs a lot of money, and there's not a lot of strategic value for doing that. So here's a sort of breakdown on sorts of activities in each layer. Layer two is where you'd see the nuts and bolts of most technology support. This is where you'd see your desktop support, your application development, your web design and content management. Up at the top, you'd have this subject matter expert that understands the difference between teaching in business and teaching in math, for example, and can translate it into a different kind of support for the local unit. Finally, down at the bottom, again, servers and storage, media and network servers. Many institutions only focus on layers two and three, especially the central IT unit. You'll see that, hey, we have a desktop, we have all this other desktop support, we have all the servers and storage, and that's supposed to work for the entire campus. This layer one being left out is actually what causes a lot of decentralized issues, because what happens is the local unit, your geography department says, I need someone that knows GIS. I need someone that knows these things. So what will happen is the local unit will buy this person or this team, and that team invariably is asked to cover all three layers. They're going to end up being your desktop support. They're going to end up doing your servers and storage because it's not coordinated with the central unit in any way. So getting back to the three layers, the focus on efficiency. Again, there's very little strategic value to running this infrastructure. The startup costs are huge. Up at the upper level, it's actually easy to get into it right away. And these are why, at the top, I would call them generally insourced services. Down at the bottom, generally outsourced. In fact, you may have noticed at your own institutions, a lot of the stuff down at the bottom is being outsourced to the cloud right now. So innovation, the focus on innovation. Again, at that top layer, we want you and your departments to try new things. We want you to innovate. Without the proper support, without having that consultation layer, you may be putting your institution or your work at risk. So that's something. And again, we get back to the core competencies at the top and the shared competencies at the bottom. This doesn't mean that these people at the bottom are less skilled. I mean, a great server administrator is a great server administrator anywhere. But having these core competencies for your particular discipline is critical. I talked about startup costs. And here, so talking about innovation, you're going to see the prototypes emerge from the top. And you know, over time, they may become enterprise services. And that's what I want to focus on next, which is this innovation life cycle. This is the cycle of potentially, at any time, an innovation can exit out. It might be new. It might stay local. If it's good enough, it'll become shared. For example, Chad's model is so good, I'm going to ask him to come to my institution and talk to my faculty, and I assume that it will become shared at that point, because other people say, wow, that's pretty neat. And you'll notice from new to shared is actually a very easy transition. There is a lot of excitement. It's faculty to faculty or staff to staff. They're saying, have you tried this? This is really neat. Not hard at all. So you'll see this happening all the time. Innovations can move from new to shared very easily. And all people are doing are they're gathering requirements. It's very organic. From shared to central, almost always falls apart. And I'm sure you've seen this, or many of you have seen this. How do you centralize a service and offer it across an institution? At that point, people get very disappointed with how the service has changed or how it's being offered. And the reason for that is that the steps in between aren't defined very well. Finally, the service is going to be maintained. And here's another thing that institutions do badly. They never retire the services. So what that does is it becomes an ever-increasing catalog, a portfolio of things that your IT support team has to take care of. And often it's just a few stakeholders. Your provost may like pine email, and that's why it's always still there, right? So that's you're going to see that everywhere. So again, going here, this cycle is almost never followed all the way through. But at the beginning, we're gathering requirements. The shared decentralizing is the attempt to standardize. Once you talk about standardization, it becomes very difficult. It becomes very difficult because you're going to leave some folks behind. Some people will be happy. A large number of people won't be. Again, these phases, they correspond to industry standard practices. These stage gate processes, you might see this at a Medtronic when they're doing a new medical device, for example. These prototypes, these pilots, and then finally going into production here. These steps being poorly defined is what prevents the innovation lifecycle from happening. But more interesting than that is how this ties all together. Going back to my three-layer model, the consultants at the top should be responsible for working on innovation, for pushing this forward. Without that first step, you can't coordinate this process. This translation layer is right there in the middle in that shared layer. As I said, you might have a certain model for support that works in the sciences. It may not work in the humanities, but you can share a support model between different units this way. And then finally, the central units should be worried about infrastructure, and that's how that ties together there. So, well, why is this different? Well, first of all, I'm actually ceding local control. I'm saying, you know, local units should be able to make decisions on how technology serves them best. This gets back to how Chad is trying to do things. We should help enable that somehow. Secondly, that person in layer one should be able to coordinate layers two and three, so making that support work for that unit. And that's a lot. I'm saying this person in the unit can actually call up my help desk and say, if we don't support Unix, for example, which then we should start supporting Unix, and we need to figure out a way to do that. That's coordinating that layer two so it works for your area. And then finally, if it's not part of the shared IT structure, again, getting back to the previous slide, that local unit will always be asked to do all three layers. And that's exactly what you don't want to do. Okay. So again, I'm hoping this helps address some of the ways to build a support structure that may support some of these innovative cloud practices we're talking about. And with that, I guess I'll move on to Jude.
Did you turn this off? Am I allowed to? Will you advance? Somebody advance for me. I was so inspired by Chad wandering, and I'm a wanderer, so I'm going to wander myself out here. So what I will pick the football up and try to move it down the field with from where Ed left us is I am that support layer, and some of you in this room are that support layer. Some of you are doing that. And so part of what I'll talk about is an actual case where we did sort of the innovation life cycle and, you know, some of the bumps in the roads that we hit. As somebody who represents that innovation life, that support layer of that innovation life cycle that Ed was talking about, one of the things that I see as my higher calling in my job is that it's ultimately my job as an academic technology consultant to help faculty remember how to dream big about their disciplines. I've never met a faculty member who is not pretty deeply inspired. They wouldn't be doing what they do if they don't love what they're doing. And I think through a series of no answers over the years,
people have just reduced their instruction to the lowest common denominator, which is lecture. And my job is to remind people and to try to tell, to inspire people to say, like, let's remember why you love this, and let's find a way to connect with what you dream about. Hopefully not just a killer test, but actually something, you know, something more interesting that's really going to connect with your passion and also help you get at what you care about in this discipline and what you care deeply about your students' learning. Go ahead. So I find all of this cloud stuff that's flowing at us tough, so when in doubt, refer back to medieval technologies and times. The course I'm going to talk to you about is actually a history course, the history of the medieval city. And I worked with Dr. Kay Ryerson on this class, and it was kind of an interesting project. Go ahead, Chet. Among many other things, and we gutted this class, it was kind of in need of an overhaul, and she had sort of identified there's a lot of things she was not able to do. But one of the things that she specifically brought as part of this course redesign to my attention was that she had these five films, right? And historians, they love media of lots of different types. And she had these five films, and she says, you know, I bring these into class because I don't want them watching them on their own. I want them dialoguing. I want my students discoursing, talking about this, critiquing the films, engaged in some kind of thing. I don't want them watching this at home alone. I want to have a conversation. And the experience that she actually had is this, right? So she takes class time to do films in class, and she has two major fault moments, right? Students either don't bother showing up at all, or if they do, they show up, the lights go down, and they're falling asleep, right? So this is a sort of a design moment, right? She wants them inspired and talking about these films that she really thinks are interesting and worthwhile, and they're sort of disengaged somehow. So go ahead. So as the educational psychologist / academic technologist in the room, the diagnosis for me is a motivational issue. The way that I think about this type of an issue is I've sort of thrown up two sort of disaggregations of the construct of motivation that I find particularly useful in design settings. So one comes from Clark and Estes, which is a great book. Well worth the read. And the way that they talk about the issues related to motivation are as choice, persistence, and effort. So in this context, it's choice. Does the student actually get engaged in the desired activity? In this case, maybe just coming to class. Are they actually bothering to engage? Persistence. Once they've started, do they keep at it? And effort. Are they actually thinking hard about the things that we care that they're thinking about, it, are they phoning this in? So that's a sort of a way to think about motivation, to disaggregate and kind of think about target design moments for us. The other, another sort of useful tool, I think, in thinking about motivational challenges comes from sort of back the Vroom's work back in the 60s. This is a really good meta-analysis that I've posted here. And the way that the sort of expectancy valence idea about motivation comes is, does the individual expect a positive outcome, and do they actually value what that outcome would be? So a way to think about this particular scenario is, do the students actually expect there's something good is going to happen by watching these films that the instructor has said? And if they do believe that a good outcome, or there's an outcome, do they care about that outcome? Do they actually value it in any way? So this is sort of a way to kind of deconstruct this. And so we said, okay, we've got a motivation problem. What are we going to do about it to sort of create an environment that's more like what she had envisioned? Go ahead. So we decided to go to the cloud because we really did not have a tool that would let us have students engaging across this large course. It was 75 students in class. She really wants them in class watching the film, and she wants them engaged in dialogue. So we went to Twitter. There's a lot that went into the pieces of this, and I'll talk about some of the considerations that we had to go through to really see, like, can we really do this? But when she started describing the kinds of interactions she wanted, I was like, that sounds an awful lot like Twitter, you know, sort of responding to different things. So the way that we structured the student experience here, students came in, they had their bring your own device that Ed was talking about. We had to do a lot of preliminary work to make sure that we weren't sort of disenfranchising students who might not have their own device. So we had to do some research to make sure that this would work. We set up actually 10 Twitter accounts for the course. And I'll talk a little bit more about this later, but when we go to the cloud from a faculty perspective, it raises this many questions. When we force students to do it in the cloud, it raises this many questions. I mean, forcing students to click an I agree button for a grade, for something that they may or may not be allowed to do based on the university's policies and infrastructure, it gets incredibly complex incredibly quickly. So we decided, we made the decision that we would click the I agree button on their behalf, and that's part of how we structured that for them. We assigned the students to each of 10, and we created a hashtag. If you're not familiar with the idea of a hashtag, it's just a nonsense word that allows you to search Twitter and sort of get your relevant pieces. So we had these 10 groups we followed. We created a closed off community. We didn't want the students to feel like, so people had to request to follow us and to see our tweets. So it was a very closed community. It was using Twitter in a non-Twitter-like way, but to create that internal kind of dialogic community. Go ahead. So this is an example of what we actually sort of found in the class. First off, five films. We used it across all five films. We had hundreds of relevant tweets, and we actually did some analysis on it, which I'll talk about later. But this was an actual conversation. So of course, Twitter, you read bottom to top, reverse chronological order. So somebody in the class poses this question. I think this was a film on early modern Siena, and the instructor says, or one of the students says, okay, so we've got a cathedral here. Why is there a gargoyle? Why is there this hellish thing on this house of God? And the students actually started trying to answer this question. Well, it's there to tell illiterate people that there is a hell out there, you know, remember, this is bad. And somebody else says, I thought they were there to guard the building from evil spirit. You know, so there's some kind of like back and forth engagement. Is it the most interesting conversation they might have? Probably not. But they certainly weren't sleeping. They were actually starting to engage each other in this dialogic conversation that the instructor had been interested in. So something we did after this, as just a sort of add-on to try to kickstart the post-film conversation, was we scraped the entire feed and then we put it into Wordle. So to just see, did some big themes emerge here that the instructor could use as a kind of a learner-centered starting point? What were they talking about? And so what were they... You tell me, what were they talking about in this Twitter feed? Somebody sees it. They were talking about the plague, right? I mean, you know, they were really interested in the plague. You can probably also guess what city this one was about. It was London. And that actually was a pretty interesting moment for the instructor, because she had been monitoring the feed and she had not really picked up that this was a really dominant theme for the students. And it was sort of a moment where she could sort of intercede and say, okay, the plague is an important theme from this. It is not the important theme. Like, we've spent a lot of time talking about this. Let me make sure that we get back to reiterating the things that I want you to take away from this film. So it almost served as like a little clicker, kind of free text clicker kind of response, where she started to see something like, this might be a cognitive distractor because it's sexy. It's death and plague, and you know, there's something else I'm hoping they're taking away from this. Go ahead. Okay. So all of the crazy things that come up when we start to think about this, okay? There's 1,000 reasons why we would choose not to do this and would never be able to pull this off. The terms of service thing, which I mentioned, you know, is it ethical or is it legal to compel students to click an I agree button to participate in coursework? How do we create an opt-out for students who aren't comfortable with that? You know, are you exacerbating digital divide issues? You know, this person has a device, but the person next to them doesn't. Our model actually worked fairly well because the students had sort of a broad time. It was very open, and they were tweeting about these different themes that they had asked, and they could just pass the device off to their neighbor. And so we did some preliminary questioning of the students. Do you have a device? If you do, would you be willing to share it? You know, totally anonymized, so people should have felt pretty comfortable saying no. We also had a couple of spare devices that we brought to the class to loan to the students. Certainly in this type of a model, this is pushing, I think, the cloud to its logical extreme in the classroom, in the sense that we are doing it live with a large group of people, and if you are going to do that, you had better have awesome wireless. You better have really awesome wireless
because you're going to hit it hard, and it's going to be a problem. And I've run into that trying to do things like this in other places. So there's lots of reasons why we wouldn't do this. One last thing I think I should mention is the issue of cyberbullying, or sort of just invigilation broadly. In our model, the students were anonymized. And we actually had a moment when a student sort of said something fairly unkind to another student who was speaking in the Twitter feed. And there was really no mechanism to sort of follow up on that. So, you know, we can do these things, and we sort of designed to sort of address these issues, and then we reintroduce these other types of issues. So there are some real things to think about here. Go ahead, Jeff. But from the instructor's perspective, this was a win. And I think she would agree with this. We published on this project in EDUCAUSE Quarterly, so you can see some of the analysis that we did. But basically, we did, our evaluation of this project included in-class observations. So we had hired an undergraduate student who was not affiliated, neutral observer, to watch what was happening and just take. And every observer that we had who came into the classroom agreed that they could see, sitting at the back of the room, what students were doing on these devices. It was dark, they're backlit machines, and we can tell what they're doing. And they were not, there was not technology drift. It was bizarre, actually. We really could see them nesting on this. Now, there could have been a, what's the effect where people know they're being observed? Sorry, I'm blanking on it. Thank you. The Hawthorne effect going on there. I can't say that that wasn't there, but we did not see that in class. We saw the students engage, tweeting. We did some analysis about the persistence issue. So did they just dump a bunch of stuff in Twitter and then sort of float off? We actually saw some really good persistence going on. So we think we saw some positive outcomes. We also surveyed the students, and Jermaine DeChad's, you know, a lot of them did not like this. They were like, I think this is distracting. But I think given the baseline data that we know, which is without some kind of an intervention, we really were not seeing any kind of cognitive engagement at all. This was a win from our perspective. So it's there. I'll just throw this out there that, how are we doing on time?
You've got time.
We got time. So Ed talked about, Ed talked about the life cycle. So what we just talked about in Ed's life cycle is really sort of pilot, right? I mean, huge resource intensive. I had to sort of show up and do all of this evaluation and figure out what's going on with the class and set up these Twitter accounts. And trust me, the instructor was not going to do this. She thinks of technology as like a heavy plow. So she was not going to set up Twitter feeds on her own. She needed a lot of assistance. As we started thinking, okay, we think there's a pedagogical there, right? We think we've hit on something. Where does this go? How do we scale this? So at the time, Ed and I were both working in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Minnesota, and we actually decided we're going to try to build this out as a sort of internal cloud-based web app, which is exactly what we did, which is Chimen. That's the tool that we've been using to do the SRS, right? So it has all of these different modes you can use it in. You can use it very similarly to how we used it in the Twitter feed, totally anonymized. That's how you're using it, interacting with it today. You can use it in a lockdown environment where you can make individual questions. But one of the real powerful things that we found with this is that we built in that Wordle component to it, right? So we built in the scraping, and we actually hired a graduate student, which everybody loves when you hire their graduate students, so that was an easy sell to get that money, from linguistics to do some semantic text analysis to make this smart. So the clouds are coming back increasingly interesting as we build some AI into the back end, and it takes almost no time because linguistics students already know how to do this. And they were sort of like excited to have something to actually apply this to that's not just their dissertation, you know, so they were pretty keen on the project. So this is actually, in my current context in the College of Pharmacy, a way that we were using the sort of free text cloud response that scaled beyond the original model. Our faculty will provide a case to the students. They'll say, you know, a patient is presenting with these symptoms. And these six symptoms go. What are you going to tell the doctor to prescribe to this? You know, what are we going to treat first? What's the first part of their therapy plan? When they do it with clickers, they have to basically cede a lot of intellectual territory at that point. You know, it's not an authentic assessment moment because they're choosing from among four things and they know one of them is the right answer. In the real world, they're just going to have to remember all the drugs that are out there and sort of make a recommendation. So, you know, we can ask them that type of a question and get these type of responses back, and it's really blown the lid off of different types of student interactive response moments that we can have. So go ahead. Okay, so that's kind of the tall and the short of what I was gonna run through here and as a takeaway. I wanted to quickly do a couple of big takeaways or some themes that we've seen, but I want to make sure we have lots of time for questions or feedback. I think one of the things, as we started talking about this, and I'll ask my colleagues to jump in if they have thoughts here, is that these vertical conversations are really often not happening. I mean, it was shocking to me how differently Ed thought about the cloud than how I think about the cloud. And in some ways, how, you know, Chad and I are fairly aligned because I'm that consultation layer at the faculty layer, but we even think about it differently. I don't think he thinks about the things that I have. And so creating some kind of a vertical conversation, whether it's our model that we're proposing or something else, is really important. And acknowledging that people are seeing these things differently. I would posit that it's very critical as we move forward that some of the things Ed was talking about, the CIOs have got to learn that they're going to have to cede some power here. It's got to go local, because if they don't, people are just going to circumvent them. In our context, I work in the academic health center, and we're very concerned. It's like, you think HIPAA's bad? Oh my God. Or FERPA, when you get HIPAA on top of that, it's a nightmare. And yet, we have all of this lockdown mechanisms, and our faculty are just forwarding their emails over to their Gmail account. You know what I mean? It's like the best laid plans, and it all lies in ruins. So we've gone through a lot of these different issues, as we've gone through. It's published, it's available. I don't know that we need to go through every individual bullet here. I'd rather sort of turn it over and open it up. If you want to keep going here, Chad. There is sort of, I guess, the last slide. Just jump through these two slides, because then I want to. I think that if I had a big takeaway that I would like to encourage all of us, is I think we've heard this a lot from the keynote speakers. There's all kinds of reasons why we should try to lock things down, and we should be thoughtful, and we need, you know, to be having vertical conversations. But we need to dream big. We have to dream big. Because I think the soul of education is in our hands, you know? And so I would like to introduce that as something that I hope we are all doing. It's, you know, scary and exciting, and I want us to sort of be intrepid and to learn from each other and to kind of keep moving in that direction. So I don't know if either one of you has like some closing thoughts before we open it up for questions. Yeah, great. We do. Okay. So why don't we, I'll get that, Chad, because I think that would be unfair. So I guess there were some questions coming in through the chime-in feed, so we can start there. You can see how it works in real life. There we go. So you created this cloud. Congratulations. Lots of questions about students. Jude, can you explain further how and why you created Twitter accounts for the students? How did they then, as a group, use them? And people are self-identifying. This is lovely. I can. How and why? How I did it was I just went to Twitter and I created some Gmail accounts for some dummy Gmail accounts for the course, because you have to have an email account to create a Twitter account. So I created some dummy Gmail accounts for the course, and then I created the Twitter accounts based on that. Is this on? Yeah, okay. The reason why I chose to do that is in discussions with the instructor, like I mentioned, she had a low threshold, and I sort of agreed with her to sort of forcing students into an activity where they have to click that I agree button. We just decided for this particular thing, it was a pilot, we wanted to kind of make it easy on the students, we wanted to sort of hedge our bets. So there was also a technical threshold that I was just worried that I was going to be supporting 75 students trying to create Twitter accounts and this kind of thing. Then what we did was we assigned them by alphabet to one of these 10 accounts, and then they, as part of their tweets to get credit, they had to include their
their X.500, their university, the part before the at in their email address. So that's how we sort of knew who said what, and could give them credit on that. I should also add that I didn't mention this in the evaluation. The graduate student who supports that class did an analysis of the feeds just for quality, and he ranked them on a kind of each tweet on a 3-point scale, good quality, sort of middle, and sort of irrelevant. And we found really good results with that. We found really interesting, thoughtful comments that the students were saying, so they weren't nattering on in namely. Does anyone, we'll do one live and one other here? Sure. Please. It is. January a year ago, EDUCAUSE Quarterly. It's just search on EDUCAUSE website for Chime In and you'll find us. Yeah. So there's a question here for Ed. Does the process that you describe tend to make the knowledge that the instructor and or students create LiveScribe notes less available to the world at large? Is the process antithetical to an open knowledge approach? I can get it on.
So actually, great question. I mean, and I hope that, you know, try to be as clear as I can. Actually, I think Jude's example of going from Twitter to Chime In is so Jude sits at that consultation layer I'm talking about. So if you innovate and you're a faculty member, you have a circle of peers you may share with. And if it doesn't work for that circle of peers, that could be the end of it. Jude, being part of the integrated team, was able to say, wow, here's some requirements for this faculty member. They might work for other faculty members. And by building this tool, I have to say, Chime In, actually, I don't know how many it's gone. Went across the entire university system, which is statewide.
We've been live with Chime In for about 18 months now, and we have over 600 classes that have been created and several thousand questions and tens of thousands of individual responses. It's been pretty popular. My faculty love it in the College of Pharmacy. So
the power of having someone serve in a consultation layer, what it does is it bridges all the divides. It gets out of the silos. Oh, this is just for math, or this is just for history in this case. And it allows that person to serve a larger number of folks, and it allows that innovation to spread across the institution. So I don't think that, I would hope that it doesn't make it less available to the world at large. In fact, it's supposed to do the opposite. Looks like Chad's got a question.
Is there sure. I think we need to take Mark Morton out for a drink after this. Feel free to identify yourself.
So the question is, are Applied Calc LiveScribe lectures available to students after the course is over? That's a good question. I take the links to the lectures on the LiveScribe site and I put them in the Moodle site for my students so they can get there through my Moodle site during the term. And when they're looking at those lectures, they can also export them as PDF, which many of them do. It's just they have sort of a paper copy of the notes. The lectures are still up there, but students won't have access, if I'm not mistaken, they won't have access to the Moodle site from previous terms. And so unless they somehow saved that link, they probably wouldn't be able to easily find their way back there. And there was another question that said, Chad, you mentioned that a couple students in every class complain that you are not teaching them. Has your innovative use of these cloud-based tools affected your course evaluations? If so, is that a concern? The answer is it has not affected them much. I think for the bulk of the students, it's probably gone up a little bit. But when I look at my evaluations, it's very clear who the two dissatisfied students are. I mean, very clear. There are two students who rate everything a one and then a clump at the top. So, I mean, it's very bimodal. But on the whole, no. I mean, it's gone up. If anything, it's on the average gone up.
Great questions. Any live questions? We can keep going to the feed. Anyone from the audience or anyone from remote? Any questions? No? I see the word concern. That's a fun word. Let's find out what people's concerns are. Okay, our good friend Mark again. Okay. If so, is that a concern? So you can see we built in some interesting components here. Let's see. Do we want, what word in the cloud are we most excited by? Where should we explore? Tools? Why did you choose to use Google Moderator rather than the forum tools in Moodle? This one's for Chad.
Yeah. Yep. That's a wonderful question. For me, the big deal was the sorting, the automatic prioritization of questions. So again, you know, I've tried different things in the past. I've tried having students just keep blogs. I tried using the forums on Moodle. And those things have certain advantages, but I found that for both of those methodologies, I had to do some sorting by hand. I had to sort of like cut and paste students' questions into a document and then try to put them into some sort of order on my own that I wanted to address them in class. And this just does that automatically, and that was a huge time saver for me. So that's what's made the difference.
I think we just saw the cloud redraw itself, so let's see if we have some new entrants into the market here. How do you handle credentialing in third-party cloud-based solutions like LiveScribe or Chime-In? Do you set up single sign-on integration? So the answer, I will speak for you, for LiveScribe is no. That's a true external third-party, you know, we're just doing that. We're just going to use this tool because the institution doesn't have a mechanism for it. Now, I can tell you that at the University of Minnesota, we do have what Ed described as the private cloud kind of version of what Chad's doing. It doesn't have the features that he wants, so some of my faculty might go to that. But we have a sort of a studio and an internal cloud-based sort of media management infrastructure. McAllister, I don't believe, has anything quite like that, although I see some colleagues in the audience who might be able to disagree with me. I don't know their situation as well. Chime-In is not third-party. It's actually built by the University of Minnesota. We built it in about 2 weeks. The basic, you know, it was very lightweight little app. It has needed precious little tending. You know, we did bring in the linguistics grad students. So that does have single sign-on authentication. Go ahead, Ed.
Is this thing live?
It's live.
Hello.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say, you know, Chime-In was written well enough that we could actually just attach the University of Minnesota's authentication system on top of it, and it worked well. Since I left the University of Minnesota, I'm now at Minnesota State University. I brought Chime-In over there, and the faculty are using it right now, and we're able to put our authentication there to handle that part of it. So it's been very well received.
Yeah, and I don't want to push Chime-In. I mean, you know, we can hold up Top Hat Monocle. I mean, there are two cloud-based, you know, like not internal cloud-based tools out there. Vendors offering this, Top Hat Monocle does something similar. I think ours is cooler because we do sorting and they just give you a histogram of the words. Ours is kind of cooler. But there's pedagogically. People are sort of exploring this. So there are ways for you to get in the cloud. I'll throw this out there that, you know, Chime-In is available. If you want it, you can have it. You have to run it yourself. We're not going to run it for you, but we've got to download and install instructions, and you can have it if you want it. We're happy to share.
It's a very small package.
It's a very small package. It's ridiculously lightweight. I've got a couple of pharmacy colleges of pharmacy that are using it across the country. So, why isn't the session the main one for this time slot? It should be cloud-based tools are going to change education more than anything over the next 5 years. Hey, your guess is as good as mine. You know, so but I will take that as high praise. We're 3 minutes shy. I know sometimes people like to sort of come up and have, you know, sort of one-on-one source question and answer. So if there are any final, does anyone have any final questions that you'd like to do? Oh, one thing I will say, I didn't include this URL, but let's just call it z.umn.edu/ELI blog. We will take all of these questions, we will create a blog there at that URL, z.umn.edu/ELI blog, and we'll respond to every question if we didn't happen to get to them all here. So we'll use the cloud to extend the conversation. This is our contact information. We're happy to, you know, chat if you have questions or now. And thank you very much for your time today.